Clean your gun and tune your bow. We're the Hunting Collective Show, calling hunters new and old. The Hunting Collective Show, where facts are facts and opinions are subjective. You're listening now to the Hunting Collective.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien, episode 171 coming to you. It's almost turkey season. We are excited. Phil, are you excited?
Yes, I'm excited. We just got, this is a sneak peek for the episode. We just got done talking to Tony Peterson and, you know, Eric Hall, my number's getting higher. It's getting higher.
Ha! Eric. Yes, we just got finished going through some of the ins and outs of turkey hunting with Tony Peterson. Tony is a writer and a expert in all things, really all things hunting, bird dogs, whitetails, turkeys. He is currently a new member of the Meat Eater team in a lot of ways, and you're going to be hearing from him in a lot of specifically whitetail ways coming up real soon on our platform. So we wanted to have him on. We can't get into specifics about exactly what he's going to be doing, but a lot of cool things in the books, and he's one of the best public land hunters and public land turkey hunters out there. So we had him on. We're excited about that. As we prepare, Phil, for your first hunt, we're only about a month away. Do you have anything? We talked about this at length with Tony, but, like, you know, you just got to give the people a little taste of what it might be like to have you out there or you feel like when you kill this turkey, you're going to celebrate, you're going to scream. Are you going to feel relieved? Are you going to be like, all right, let's go, that was great? Do you just take people through what your emotions might be with your first turkey? It's only a month away, dude. We've been waiting for this for literally a year probably, and now we're coming up on the time when it's going to happen.
Yeah, we were going to be in Texas about this time last year. So yeah, it's been over a year.
We've been through a lot. We've been through pandemics. We've been through Barry Gilbert.
that's true. Wow.
We've been through Valerius Geist. We've eaten veggie burgers. I mean, we've done a lot since this time when you decided you might want to go hunting, and we got Chuck Norris and David Hasselhoff to convince you.
Yeah, man, my good friends. We're actually getting dinner tomorrow. I can't wait. I'm
really good guys.
Yeah, they're flying out here just to see me. honestly, I mean, like, I'm sure the moment will be thrilling, and the moments leading up to that big moment will also be exciting. I don't see myself hooting and hollering and taking a grip and grin. I mean, maybe I will. I don't know. It's hard to look from the outside in on something I haven't experienced yet, but, I think I'll take it in stride.
Yeah, I think you will too. I think you will too. There's just so much to think of, but this is going to be our first podcast. Obviously, we plan to do another podcast when Phil and I go to the range. Hopefully, we can pull together. Maybe Giannis Patelis will come with us. Maybe Cal will come with us. Who knows? We'll do another podcast at the range, and then you'll likely be, I'd say, second week of May, third week of May. You'll be hearing live and in color. Not live and in color, but in color and in your ears, Phil on his first hunt from start to finish. We're going to make an audio symphony for you of Phil's first hunt, so everybody can get ready for that. One thing, hey, can I do a couple corrections real quick, Phil?
Please.
You mind? I don't often go back and listen to shows that we've done, but I try not to because I don't know if anybody should like to hear the sound of their own voice, but I particularly don't. But a couple folks wrote in, and particularly some people that I really respect within backcountry hunters and anglers, to ask me or to call me out a little bit and ask questions around my position on archery seasons in Montana, specifically for elk and crossbows. It's something that I don't know that everyone, obviously most opinions, not everyone will agree, but it's something that groups that I belong to and am in leadership positions for don't agree with my particular view on the crossbows during archery elk season. I wanted to say a couple of things. One, Phil, do you remember this part of the conversation, or do you think I should rehash a little bit of how it is?
I think it's been a while. Maybe just like a quick recap.
a quick recap of it. I'm going to make it simple. There's a contingent of Montana hunters who would like to not allow crossbows into the archery elk season for many reasons. Primary of those being that it would increase the harvest rate, increase success rates, which would then increase the harvest, which would then possibly force Montana Fish and Game to shorten the season to manage for that increase in success. My feeling, and again, it's not a myopic opinion. A lot of people have a lot of other more intricate ways to present their opposition to crossbows during this season. My feeling is that, quite simply, if there is a more effective killing tool to be used, we should use it. And that we should be thinking about the efficacy of our hunting. And if we have to shorten our seasons, we have to adjust the way we do things to make it more efficient within an archery season. That's what we should do. There's a lot of people that disagree with that point. There's a lot of people that agree with it. I'm boiling it down so we can move on, but that's basically where we are. I've heard from a lot of people that either agree or disagree, but one thing after going back and listening to it and my conversation with Dr. James Tantillo from Cornell, one thing I'd like to apologize for and correct is the way that I approached anyone that had an opposition to my opinion, because there's a lot of people I really respect that oppose my opinion. I was way, way too flippant in the way that I described someone who would like to restrict crossbow use during archery season. I think I called them selfish. If I didn't call them outright selfish, I made it seem like they were being selfish. I was dismissive of the opinion, and it wasn't the way that I was acting was not going to foster the dialogue that I want to foster and the way that we try to approach these important and complex issues on this show. So I apologize for that. I was caught up in a conversation and I let out a framing of that issue in a way I shouldn't have. So I apologize for that. It's not that everyone that disagrees with me is selfish and I'm self-righteous. It's that's the way that came across. That's not the way it should have came across. So I guess what I just wanted to say was it's a disagreement or a difference of opinion on a topic is exactly what we're here to suss out, to figure out. But the way that I went about approaching, setting up that debate, or my side and possibly the other side, was unfortunate. It didn't shine well on me. So I apologize for that. And everybody that listened to episode 169, hopefully I can learn from that and be a better representative of these dialogues, a better representative of everyone that listens to this here program. And so we won't belabor that, but that's my apology for that. Phil, I don't know that I probably could go back and listen to all my podcasts and apologize for something I said in each one, I bet. But this particular one came to light, and so I'm apologizing for it. I don't really have any excuse for it other than I sounded like a jackass. So any commentary, Philip?
No, but I don't envy your position, Ben. The thought of having an entire backlog of hours of things that you'd say into a microphone when sometimes you're still processing your thoughts and opinions, but then someone can go back and hold like 800 things against you. It's not a fun place to be in, I would assume. But hey, I think it's important to address some of the ones that stick out to you. I think that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think particularly when it comes to some of these issues, I sit on the national board for the North American board for backcountry hunters and anglers, and I take that position seriously. I take that as a position of leadership, and someone is entrusting me to not only think through the way that I approach things, but how I approach things. And so even with our conversation today about mentoring, being a mentor to you, or to promoting THC as a place where other people can come to be mentored or mentor themselves is important. I think all these positions we put ourselves in of leadership, it's important to address the positions that we're in and not act like, well, it's tough to be in a position of leadership or a position. I'm here voluntarily. You're not really here voluntarily, unfortunately, but I am. So that, I think this all goes well into a bit of a controversy that's laid out across the meat eater landscape and really across the hunting community over the last week or so. So I'd like to address that, Phil, if you don't mind, before we get to Tony Peterson. It's something that obviously I feel very strongly about. I've shaped my life around the hunting community. I've shaped my life around trying to grow it and trying to be a positive force within it. It's something that is not only my job, but it's a community of people that I care about. This is an extremely important thing for me personally, and for the listener of this podcast. The article that Matt Rinella wrote was called The Case Against Hunter Recruitment. Now, for this particular show, let's try to set the stage here. For this particular program, we are hosted by, owned by, a part of the Meat Eater Network. Meat Eater Podcast Network, Meat Eater Incorporated, the company itself, which has a myriad of different voices across the landscape when it comes to whitetails or mules in Arkansas or guys with mustaches here in Bozeman. We have a myriad of voices across this country. And all of those voices I respect, all of those voices I want to be heard, and I'm happy to be a part of a company where we can hear them, and I can work with those individuals to help tell our story as hunters, to help promote what we do. And that is both internally and externally. Internally, amongst the hunting community, we need to promote a more inclusive culture. We need to promote a better way of thinking about the ethics and morality of killing, and we need to find a way to then take that to the broader external audience and help explain to them why we love this thing so much. And when they try to vilify us, we go at them, as we've talked about on this show so many times, the level head, and explain to them why our value system around hunting is so important, both personally, but also on an ecosystem level. So I say all that to say a lot of people I think I could call friends, a lot of people that I would call industry friends, acquaintances within the industry are pretty pissed off about this article called The Case Against Hunter Recruitment by Matt Rinella. Matt is the brother of Steve Rinella, the founder of our company. He's also a research ecologist who I've hung out with a few times and I find to be a great person. And he's devoted his life to hunting and conservation. You've heard him on Meat Eater podcasts. We've done live shows with him. I did a few live shows with him. He's a hilarious guy. And anybody that listens to the Meat Eater channels knows that for years now, he's been debating the merits of hunter recruitment with his brother and with anybody that'll probably listen. And really, it's antithetical to what we do here at Meat Eater. I don't want to get caught up in listing Meat Eater or Steve Rinella or anyone else's resume when it comes to hunter recruitment, but I feel like we've done a pretty good job. I'm proud of that. And this article, The Case Against R3, The Case Against Hunter Recruitment, Matt makes a whole lot of points, almost none of which I agree with. And if Matt was in this room right now, which he's not, we'd probably have a nice argument about it. We'd go back and forth. I would state my case. He would state his case. We would go on from there. It's different, I understand, when it is in the public forum, when he's writing an article. And it's different, I understand, when there's a foreword to this article by his brother, Steve, and it shows up on our radar. I understand all those things are different. I'm not going to go through the point by point of this article. If you'd like to read it, you can go to themeateater.com or you can just search The Case Against Hunter Recruitment. You'll find Matt's article. You can read it and decide for yourself what you would like to do with it, whether it pushes you to have debates amongst your friends, whether it pushes you to think a little bit more about hunter recruitment and how to do it, it's up to you. So what I will say about this article itself and kind of the reaction, there was an article posted in Outdoor Life as a rebuttal to Matt's article. And there was also an article posted by Lydia of Hunters of Color, which I read. I just feel like we're in a position now where there's a couple different ways we can go. And I'll just explain the way that I see this. First, as I said a little bit a minute ago, I absolutely, positively, I think about R3 hunter recruitment and how to do it more than I think about just about anything else. Turkey hunting, save maybe turkey hunting right now. It's something that I believe wholly in. We're building our THC cult here and our family of THC listeners around this idea that it is not only integral to our community that we promote hunting and bring people hunting. It's integral to us. Everything is better when you're teaching someone and helping them to follow your passion. Everything is better when you're doing that. And as I've said before, I feel like if someone approaches you and says, I'd like to learn, I would like to go hunting, and you don't know them, and you tell them no, that ain't good for you. It's not a good look. It looks selfish. It looks like we have an insular culture rather than an accepting one. So it's just not a good look. But I'll follow that up with saying, Matt Rinella is somebody that I know, that I know to be a good person, and I know to be somebody I'd like to listen to and hear out his thoughts. So I read all the articles and different rebuttals and some of the outcry online about Matt's article. But as a way of getting to the point, as with most op-ed pieces, most opinion pieces on any website, and that's clearly what Matt's article is, his argument against organized R3 references, it just does not capture the sentiment of everyone here at Mediator, does not capture my sentiment. And I think that's probably obvious given what you're listening to right now. But I also think acknowledging that there is a case to be made against R3 and being open to that reasoning is as important as anything we can do. It's extremely important. Whether I agree with Matt or not, it's important to hear him out. This whole dialogue can spark a healthy debate, which I think is happening right now, or it can be conflated into damning an entire company, an entire brand. We can do either one or both. But I don't think that everyone at our company, this podcast, or guys like Mark Kenyon or Ryan Callahan, who have fought for years for access and for hunter recruitment, Mark Kenyon himself and I have worked very hard to donate our back 40 property, or 64 acres in Michigan, to the National Deer Association for exactly R3 efforts for hunter recruitment. We just did a whole big giveaway and an episode about that. So conflating Matt Rinella's opinion with our entire company, our entire brand, everyone in it, it's just not fair. Same way as if there was somebody that wrote an opinion you agreed with on our website and you said, man, Mediator is the best because of this opinion. I don't disagree that we could have been a little bit more forward, that this was an opinion, not our opinion. But I have to read the article, it's pretty clear that that's what's going on. I think hunter recruitment, groups like Hunters of Color, and groups now like THC, are important and vital for the future of our community. But as for Matt, I'll defend his right to state his case, even though I don't agree. Still the year of the new hunter for me. Still going to keep on going. I understand if you've probably not read this article and you've not read the Outdoor Life or Hunters of Color rebuttals to the article, that you might not understand what I'm talking about. But go and do it and then come back and listen to this again, because it really boils down to, how do we grow hunting? How do we grow its acceptance in society? And how do we grow tolerance and community inside? And that's it for me. I'm as passionate about this idea as I am anything I've ever said on this podcast. And I promise you, the future of my career, the future of Mediator, and the future of everyone talking into microphones or looking into cameras at this company will be fraught with debates like this, but also will be marked by us pushing forward into the future and trying to get more people to understand what we do and come be a part of it. If you've ever watched anyone in our company, from the Mediator flagship Netflix show to Cal's Week in Review to Giannis's Mediator Hunts, you'll know what I'm talking about. And you'll know that's our mission. So I'm not going to fight over it, but I will state my passion clearly. And now we're going to teach Phil how to turkey hunt. On to Phil and Tony J. Peterson, writer, turkey hunter extraordinaire. Tony Peterson, how are you, sir?
I am excellent, buddy. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. It's I was just telling you, we had a wind storm at our house last night, so we have power. It's been a sketchy day, but it's sunny outside. Yesterday was like 55 degrees.
Oh man.
Which means it's time to start thinking about, no, it's not time to start thinking about turkeys. It's time to start like getting our gear ready. Like, because I guess you guys, when does your season open up there?
Here in Minnesota is the 14th.
Okay. So yeah, you're like us. We're the 11th roughly here in Montana. So it's time though. I'm going to Texas on Wednesday.
Ooh.
It's going to be fun.
Texas is always fun for turkeys.
Isn't it? Like, yeah, there's a lot of things we could do with this conversation. We could probably list our favorite turkey destinations. And I got to say, like, Texas is one of my top, only because you go to Walmart and you get four turkey tags.
Yep.
And they just don't care. And most landowners are like, hey, listen, if it doesn't have horns or antlers, you can do whatever you want.
Yep. Yeah. Texas is a wonderful destination for a turkey hunter.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the Rios are fun. We're going down south near the border, and then for the last, well, not last couple of days, but a couple of days of the southern zone season, and then going up to the northern zone by Austin for the opening day of their season on the, I think on the 4th it is, or the 3rd.
Oh, man.
It's the beginning of it all.
I know it. It's awesome.
All right, well, we got a lot to do. Phil's here, so he's still here. He's hanging on.
Hey, Phil.
Hey, how's it going, Tony? Ben, what does that mean? What are you implying?
Just normally you're not here for the interview part of the show.
Oh, that's right. This is a special occasion, though.
And also, I just mean, like, you know, mentally, physically, you're just hanging on at this point with,
you know, Ben,
with
I'm,
THC.
I'm doing, oh, with THC, of course. I'm always just barely hanging on with THC. But in general, I would say I'm doing pretty well. I'm feeling good, feeling optimistic.
Good. Yeah. Well, it's a big, you got a big couple of months here. We have about a month to prepare for your first ever hunt, your first ever turkey hunt. And I mean, people were asking me the other day, have you ever shot a shotgun? A gentleman at a church my wife and I go to started to ask me all these questions. I'm like, I don't know. I'm pretty sure that you've never shot a shotgun for the purposes of hitting anything.
That is correct. Yes.
Perfect. Okay. Let me make that clear. Tony, do you have any preliminary questions before we get to the subject at hand? Because basically, Phil's going to go hunt first week of May. It's his first hunt ever. We've talked a little bit about gun safety a while back. We're going to start to get it onto, like, what is a turkey? Why is it awesome to hunt? It's hard to keep Phil excited, but this is what we really got to do here.
Well, so this is a Montana hunt, I'm assuming?
It is, yep.
And what kind of shotgun is he using?
He's going to be using a Weatherby 18i. And we've got 3-inch TSS loads. We've got a, I got it right here. Let me get it out. Hold on. I'll figure out what choke is in it because I just switched chokes out. But it's got a TSS. It's got a Carlson's TSS choke in it. So he's going to be well healed. I've got a Vortex Solar red dot on it. So you'll be well healed. You'll be well healed to kill a turkey, Phil.
There will be no excuse to miss.
12 gauge. Yeah.
12
gauge. That's what I feel like. It might hurt Phil a little bit. It might hurt you, but it definitely isn't going to tickle the turkey. The turkey has no chance if you put it in the right spot.
Yep. Yep.
So we got to get through all that. But first, Tony, you got to tell us, like, what are your turkey plans for this year?
Man, I have a new puppy coming this spring, so I kind of reined in my travel a little bit. But I've got, this is a perfect podcast for me because I am actively in the process of getting my 9-year-old girls ready for their second turkey season.
Nice.
And so we are shooting the 410, and I hope we just did one session. You know, they shot last year and they both killed birds, but they were really really scared of the shotgun this year. And I don't know why. And so we started with a 410, or sorry, we started with a 22. And then to get them to bump up to the 410, they were like real cagey. So it long story short, it ended up costing me $40 and two Twinkies, but I got them shooting it.
Phil, do you like Twinkies?
Oh, I love a Twinkie.
All right.
Yeah. So that was like those oily chemicals just chewing. Yep. Chewing in between the sponge cake and that frosting. It's great. There's nothing better.
This could be 20 years old. It could be 50. Nobody knows.
No way of knowing. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, they don't expire. So my focus right now, in fact, we were out yesterday putting up some blinds, is get them on birds, and then I'll do my own Minnesota thing and then skip across the border and hunt Wisconsin. And then I drew an Iowa tag. So I'm sticking close to home, but I'm going to get a few states in and bow hunt some birds and gun hunt some birds.
Sweet, man. Yeah, I mean, I'm there. My son is 4. My engineer is in his early 30s, and I got to teach both them kind of. But that's, we went out, my son and I went out, and
similar interests as well between the two of us.
They both play video games.
Dinosaurs.
But my son and I went out, and he's never hunted with me. We've done a ton of fishing, ice fishing. Across the board. And so he understands hunting. Like when we go out, we talk about it, but I, you know, being a 4-year-old, I just haven't taken him with me yet. But I feel like this is the year that I'm going to take him with me. And we, to kind of preface all of it for him, I took him out. I knew there were some turkeys on some local public land. I took him out a couple weeks ago and I showed him a turkey. There's a turkey. So interesting. Described to them, you know, winter flocks, what they do. And then we just took an old cottonwood tree, busted it up, that had fallen down, busted up and made a little blind. As I come to find out, it's called an Arkansas blind, but where I came from, it's more like a Maryland blind. You just take some sticks and make a hideout. And so he loved that, man. It's just like building a fort in the woods with your dad is a fun thing to have. Did you ever do anything like that, Tony, where you just kind of started them off with like general interest in the outdoors?
Oh, big time, man. I was thinking, you know, when you said he was 4, I think my girls first sat with me when I was 5, or when they were 5. And they got to watch me shoot a couple turkeys and then, you know, last year actually hunt. But I also brought them out and we did some, you know, squirrel hunting and, you know, put your back to a tree kind of stuff and just, or even duck hunting too, get them in the blind. And so it was just a matter of like that soft exposure, like get them into the fun stuff. And it doesn't, you know how kids are, man. It doesn't take them long to find cool stuff out there and dig it as long as you keep them going, you know?
That's right. Yeah. And so, yeah, we've done a lot of bird watching. Like we've done a lot of animal identification. Went to Yellowstone over the weekend. I'm telling them that's a bighorn sheep. This is a ram. This is a ewe. Like, so that's where I'm at right now. But this year I do want to get him in a turkey blind. Call one in, say, put the muffs on. Daddy's gonna shoot it in the face. And this is what it's like, and just kind of gauge his reaction. Because you just don't really know, right? There's no idea how they're going to react, how many Twinkies you're going to have to buy.
Well, you're going to need snacks. I promise you that.
Yeah. Ice fishing was basically just my son with a giant bag of trail mix playing Find the M&Ms. That was the entire deal. We did catch a couple of perch, but beyond that, he was just like, what's the next snack that I'm going to eat, Dad?
Yep.
Please, please, please. So that's where I'm at this year, but I am going to Texas. We have a 4-state turkey tour. I'm sure you've probably hunted a lot of this area we're going. We're doing Eastern Montana. And then the Black Hills of Wyoming and South Dakota, and then also the piney ridges of Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. I've been through many of those places, buddy.
I know you have. Drop me some waypoints.
I could send you a few spots, but it's, you know, that whole vein of habitat that you're talking about from Eastern Montana down, it's just so awesome. I mean, it's so easy to understand when you get out there why it's such a destination, whether you're in South Dakota or Wyoming or you skip down to Nebraska. It's just awesome. And the birds are so beautiful, and the country is just, it's like a weird, not too strenuous Western hunt.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And especially in the Black Hills, nobody go there. obviously, especially not in April of this year.
Yeah.
we've got a hot topic where, when it comes to other people in the woods at Meat Eater right now.
Yeah, I heard.
That's a bit of a firestorm. So all seriousness, you're welcome wherever I go. I do think that when you hunt that country, you realize, man, that it's such, you have like big blocks of timber, but big open ridges, especially in that, the Pine Ridge there in Nebraska. It's such varied country. You know, we killed a doe up there two Decembers ago in kind of an ag field tucked in some public ground that was right by where a buddy of mine was texting me that he was watching a bighorn ram. And there, a hunter that had the Nebraska tag for the ram was in there stalking it, and he was watching that. And I'm like, dude, I'm sitting in an ag field maybe a mile away from you.
It's amazing.
Watching white-tailed does, which I guess probably notes kind of the kind of country that you're in and the kind of opportunities that are in there. But yeah, anyway, we're doing that. You can follow us at First Light. We're doing a turkey tour. We're calling it like the Trek for Turks. We're going to do like a telethon for NWTF. A lot of details to come for that with our boys at First Light. But we're going to be out there with Kevin Harlander and Ford Van Fossen, a bunch of people from First Light. We're going to be trying to kill some turkeys and raise some money for NWTF and highlight some essential projects out at that part of the world.
I love it, man.
In the western part of our United States, because you know, NWTF, this is probably a whole nother conversation, but NWTF has, without a banquet season or with a limited banquet season this year, for folks that don't know, NWTF, RMEF, a lot of these, DU, Ducks Unlimited, a lot of these conservation organizations run on banquet, I guess, revenue, as you would call it, membership drives, auctions, all the things that happen at any particular banquet. Those things aren't happening at all, or very many of them this year. So we're going to try to help NWTF replace a lot of the loss that they'll have there and have had since the pandemic has kicked off here almost a year ago, over a year ago.
That's a good cause, man.
It is. But now, Phil, we got to get to this. Phil was telling me beforehand that he didn't really have a whole lot of questions. Is that right, Phil? You don't have like a whole lot of burning turkey questions?
Well, that's true. It's just, it's tough when I have not fired a shotgun and I've never actually been out in the field and kind of even gotten the 101 basics about this stuff. Obviously, I've been a part of enough Meat Eater podcasts and THC podcasts where there was a lot of turkey talk and discussions about their behavior and how finicky and unpredictable it is and all that kind of stuff. But I still don't really know the absolute like foundational stuff to get started with turkey hunting.
Yeah. Well, that's good. As always, you'll be a proxy for all our audience here, people that are emergent hunters or new hunters, and they want to learn. Because quite honestly, I don't know if, you know, we're talking about how we have our kids in this, but it's good even for seasoned hunters to take a few steps back and kind of explain it from the beginning. I think it's a helpful exercise for both mentor, mentee, things of that nature. What do you think? What do you think, Tony?
Man, I've been saying for a few years, you know, I grew up shotgun hunting turkey, so it was just a run and gun festival. And then I got into the bow hunting thing and realized how different my interactions with turkeys were and just how different the experience was. And I was like, if you really want to get well-rounded, do both of these things. And then I started taking my little girls and I'm like, man, if you really want to get well-rounded, take somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, because you have such different considerations and you just realize how much you take for granted as far as being able to call or, you know, kind of just understanding the layout of some of your decoy spreads and things like that, all the way down to just movement. And so taking somebody new is really, it really forces you to consider every setup and every, you know, like every potential mistake that's going to be made, because a bunch of them will be made.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. The things that I think, like, get out of the truck, don't slam the door, all the things, you know, why does a turkey roost? Where do they generally roost? You know, when do they fly down? Why do they fly down when they do? When they hit the ground, what are they thinking about? Like all of those things. We'll get into all that here. And that's kind of how I want to approach this. But those are questions that if it's just me and you, Tony, or just me by myself, those questions don't even pop in my head. It's kind of you get to be where it's a reflex a bit. and you're thinking about, you're really thinking about kind of the minutiae, the intricate points, just like anything else. When you've done it a lot, you get to know that like these are the key moments where success and failure occur. Like these, you know, I got to be where this bird wants to be, or I got to shut up, or I got to talk more. I got to, you know, back off the roost, or I got to charge in there and get under the damn tree. These are the things that, you know, generally start to think about once you've done it a while. But when you haven't done that, you got to pull it back and, you know, go back to the fundamentals and do those things right.
Yep.
And be able to discuss them as well. So what do we start? Where do we start here, Tony?
So I would say for Phil, I, you know, the one great opportunity, you know, you kind of mentioned this with the gun you're setting him up with, is that gun, if he gets comfortable with it, that part is kind of taken care of. Like the scary part of not being able to hit him or not knowing if you're going to hit him or get him, when you see what a good turkey gun is capable of, it's like a really nice confidence booster. So you kind of like work backwards from that, right? Like, okay, now I know if I get that bird within, you know, 30, 40 yards or whatever, wherever you want him, at least, you know, if you get that red dot on his skull, he's toast, you know, and that's like a nice place to start. So you can actually get a lot of turkey confidence just at the range, especially if you have somebody else calling for you and doing most of the heavy lifting. But I think the mistakes that newbies make, and everybody does this is how you learn it, is like that red zone, like, you know, they get to maybe within 100 yards or 75 yards, and they're just, you know, they're not as prone to running in like crazy that you see a lot on the outdoor shows and stuff. A lot of the birds that you guys are probably going to be hunting are not going to be like sprinting in suicidal, even if you're dealing with 2-year-olds. And there's like that time frame between 80 yards and 35 that matters so much. And that's when one movement or one thing that's just a little off changes the whole dynamic and turns it into panic mode. So I think like really just paying attention if you've got one, you know, that you think is getting kind of within that range, because that's when they surprise you and you screw everything up. And if you make that move and something goes wrong, or their demeanor changes a little bit, then the panic starts creeping in and the wheels start falling off bad.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so many times where you got a bird that's gobbling, you're all excited, you're getting ready, and then he shuts up, and you 10 minutes goes by, you relax, you let your guard down, and then you hear that spitting and drumming right behind your head.
Yep.
You're like, oh, that's what he did, didn't he? I can't tell you how many times I've had that happen.
Oh man.
And too many.
Yeah. And you just can't, it's never, you think, oh, they're going to come right down this two track right into our lap, and they come from the exact opposite direction. I mean, I'll never forget. I took my wife out, probably 10 years ago, and we set up in the corner of this field, and she was in front of me and I was behind calling, just because I figured, you know, they're going to pop out in the field. And pretty soon I heard a bird coming straight behind us, and she just looked around the tree like, you know, this big whack-a-mole popping out there. And of course that bird ran away, and I was like, honey, what are you doing? And she's like, I just didn't expect a turkey to come from there. And I'm like, well, you know, like, I don't know what to say to you. Like, they could, we're out in the woods, they can come from anywhere, but it's easy mistakes to make.
Yeah, there are. So you got to kind of have that understanding, that they, I guess let's run through the turkey senses for Phil. Cause I've obviously different types of hunts, you're thinking of different types of things and at different times of the year. If we're hunting fall turkeys, it'd be a whole different conversation, obviously.
Yeah, for sure. You know, obviously they're amazing at, you know, location and what they hear. I mean, they know where you are. You don't want to make, you don't want to make the wrong noises. And, you know, they see so well, but they have this blind spot when it comes to really good decoys, if you let the situation unfold, you know. So if you, the problem is you move at the wrong time when they're not fully bought into that decoy trance, but their eyesight, and they learn to, like, they're kind of like an antelope. They don't expect you to be super close to them. So sometimes they do really dumb stuff when you get inside their guard because they're so confident in their eyesight. Turkeys are like that. And when they buy into that decoy spread, it's like amazing what you can get away with. I mean, I'll never forget. I took one of my wife's relatives quite a few years ago on his first turkey hunt, and I called in three birds. They came into the decoys, and he shot one, and the whole morning I'd been like, we can't move, we can't do this, blah, blah, blah. And then he kills this bird, and the other one stuck around and let me shoot 1,000 photos of it. And I had to get out of the blind and scare it away. And it's like, just when they get bought into that, there's just, something about it. You know, if they're a little wiggy coming in, it might be a different story, but a lot of times the best thing is like just to really understand that if you let it unfold and he sits there at 40, 50 yards and he looks at it and you'll see him buy into it, just like a whitetail with a decoy. And when they do, they're toast. Like you can get away with a lot more. So it's like they know their senses are so top notch, but once they get past that and they go, well, this is a safe thing. And here's this Jake, I want to kick his ass, or here's this hen. It's just the whole dynamic changes.
Yeah, you're right about that. And there's so many different, I mean, you get from hunt to hunt to hunt to hunt, especially where we are. I've had that. I took a guy out one time in Texas who worked at Yeti. He was an engineer. Nice guy, similar to you, Phil, had similar age, I think. Had already had kids, was kind of an emergent hunter himself, and had never shot a shotgun, or maybe only once or twice. He was a little bit worried about the shotgun. He was a little bit nervous about almost everything that happened on the hunt. I ended up calling three times, three giant times, by the way, off this little water tank, as they call it in Texas, kind of the lip of this tank down across the field. We weren't really even in any cover. We sat down in like a mesquite bush that was out in the middle of a wide open field. It was the worst cover I've ever seen. And I don't even think I got the decoy out before I think I hit the call one time just to see if they would gobble, because they were a good ways away. And then they just started running at us and did a full on suicide squad. And so I just said, get ready, here they come. And they ran into about 20 yards. And normally if you had a decoy there, they'd have been on that decoy. They'd have hopped on that Jake, or they'd have been posturing for that hen, but they were just charging at the sound. And so he got nervous. They got nervous. He shoots, kills two of them with one shot. The third one goes like 10 yards out, comes back, he shoots and kills that one too. So no pressure, Phil, but that guy, I took him on his first hunt. And he shot three turkeys. He had no idea that that was a thing that was like a once in a lifetime, if ever. Have you ever shot three turkeys with two shots, Tony?
No. I will say I took somebody out who shot three with one shot one time in the fall.
Yes.
Which was not a good thing. This was not,
yeah.
I was not cheering his decision to shoot at that moment.
In this case, it was a good thing. He had four tags. He filled three of them. But yeah, I mean, that's you just never know. And it's, you gotta be able to read the turkey, you know, what's he doing? How's he, it's a conversation that you're having. But let's take a few steps back. Like we're going to, Phil, I won't get into specifics of where we're going to go, but we're going to be in Montana, and we're going to be likely in some, you know, river corridor, riparian zone stuff where turkeys are roosting in big cottonwood trees, flying down and pitching toward ag. Normally they had to run, they got to get through the timber to get to the ag. It's generally probably where we're going to be, I would think. A lot of options though. We can go a lot of places, but let's start like in the truck, Tony. Like I said, you got to think about like, when you get out of the truck, what are we, you know, it's 4 a.m, you're tired, your brain's probably not working as well as it ought to. But then you get out of the truck and you're headed over to a roost tree. Like the first thing you think of is what? Gun safety? Quiet?
Well, yeah, all of the above. You know, you take somebody out new, you're always thinking gun safety. But to me, it kind of depends on, is this a true run and gun situation where you're waiting for a gobble and you're going to, you know, you don't know which tree you're going to put your back to, or you kind of got an idea like, okay, they like to fly down here and we're going to set up here and they, you know, we might call them past. And I've taken new turkey hunters on that run and gun mission, but they've always been people who are pretty competent with hunting other stuff. I get a little nervous about that with somebody who's a true newbie and in one of those dynamic situations where, you know, you might get pinned down on marginal cover, like you said, or you just don't really, you've left a lot up to just the whims of nature, you know?
Yeah. I think, I'm with you. I imagine the hunt that I'm hoping that we'll get to do, Phil, is basically we'll have the birds roosted. Me and you can even drive, hopefully it's a quick drive over there, roost these turkeys essentially, which just means watch what tree they fly up in, mark it, and then decide, you know, what are their travel corridors? Like, where do they want to go? Where do they want to be when they fly down? And then we'll go, we'll get in there early in the morning and we'll get set up, put some decoys out. To your point, Tony, and again, like, if we're going to run and gun, I'll carry the shotgun just to help, you know, Phil, so you can be comfortable that you don't have to worry about that when we're moving around in the woods, if we have to crawl, if we've got to, you know, scoot on our ass, if we, you know, whatever we got to do. I would generally do that with most new hunters anyway. But to your point, Tony, it just makes more sense, one, to learn the birds, to just be stable, have a good decoy set, and get to experience the turkey in kind of a less frantic way.
Yeah.
You know, in a more direct way.
Will this be later in the season? This won't be right on the opener, will it, Ben?
No, it'll be the first week of May, but really here, I don't have a whole lot of it's my second or third season in Montana. I don't have a whole lot of experience, but in my limited experience, you know, that first week of May is pretty good.
Yeah.
Depending on the weather.
Do you think they'll be on like a better grasshopper kind of bug pattern by then?
That would be my guess, yeah.
Yeah.
My hope.
Yeah. So that'll be, that'll probably work in your favor a little bit. They'll be spread out a little bit more. You might get some really good midday movement then too.
Yep. Yeah. So I think, I mean, let's just say the scenario is that we're parking, you know, I'm trying to picture one of our scenarios here. We're parking roughly 1,000 yards from the roost tree and we're hitting a trailhead. And we're getting into the woods and we're setting up. We've got our cover already decided. We got to get our decoy set up. Take us through that, Tony. I mean, because right now I have about 6 or 7 options for what Phil and I can do, but I was trying to give him a good idea of, and then we can talk about run and gun a little bit too.
How geeky do you want to get?
Let's get real. How geeky do you want us to get, Phil? Do you have any questions yet?
Not yet, but I do encourage as much geekiness as possible. So
okay,
all right. Well, if that's me, if I'm you, Ben, in that situation, I'm trying. You know, the one thing I love about turkeys that we're starting to give them more credit for, but we're still not there, is how patternable they are, even when it seems like it's totally random and they're just cruising across the countryside. And so, any of those times where you can get out there and watch them get off that roost and pay attention to where are the hot spots, like where are these places they show up, you know, and trail cameras are freaking phenomenal for this in some situations too. But just anytime you can get ahead of the game a little bit and go, I've got like A, B, and C, and they're all, there's birds going through there multiple times a day, or they're within hearing range easy of these spots multiple times a day. That time of the season when you get on that, you know, the hens will be nesting a little bit and they'll be on that just random bug pattern. I love that, like,
yeah,
I don't know, 10 o'clock in the morning time frame. And because it's getting late enough in the season, I would probably still use a quarter strut Jake and a lay down hen and then maybe one other hen. But that's the time of the season when I start paring back a little bit on my, the amount of decoys. When I start out in the early season, like when I have my little girls out, we'll have a pile of decoys out. I want to look like a whole little flock. And as you see the spring really take hold, you kind of, I do better when I pare back and pare back more. And by the end of May, I'm down to one single hen, but that time frame will be perfect for like, identify a couple of those spots that, you know, you have good, you know, some kind of good tree to set up on or deadfall or something. And then, you know, get a couple of decoys out there in the right spot and give it some time in each one of those, and, you know, not necessarily, you know, running after the next gobble every time, but that time of year is good for giving each spot, you know, maybe 2 hours or something like that.
Yeah. That's exactly how I run it at that time of year. I start by looking, there's generally, I guess, Phil, there's two ways you can look at this. Let's say we were hitting a brand new piece of country, right? And we didn't know if there were turkeys there or where they might be. We're going to try to locate birds, right? In the morning, we're going to use owl hooter. You know, in the day, we're going to use, you know, really loud yelps, and then for locating, and then crow calls if we want to shot gobble a turkey. But in many of the cases that we're going to be trying, I'll know about where their turkeys are, about where they want to go. And again, I will have found the path of least resistance earlier in the season, and understand, like you said, Tony, there's going to be pinch points in the terrain as well that you can yep. focus on, and places where you know they're going to want to travel through, even if they're on the bug pattern or if they're just, you know, fully engulfed in finding a hen or fully engulfed in finding a fight. There's just going to be places where they can work through easier, especially in the Western terrain. You know, a lot of times in the Midwest, turkeys are going to travel like agricultural edges or next to timber or along creek bottoms. In some of the terrain that we'll be in, it's benches, but it really could just ends up being what's the path of least resistance sometimes to get to where they yeah. want to be.
Well, and that's a good point, man. I don't think people, when we think about, you know, if I just conjure up a Montana turkey hunt in the first week of May, I envision beautiful weather. You know, like it's just so, it's so, yeah. such a default, you know, headspace to go to. But when you do that homework and you get on those spots they like to travel anyway, you're hedging your bets against that super windy morning or that rainy day or just the weather that isn't ideal. You're already in a place where those turkeys like to travel, and they're so much easier to call when you're already where they like to go.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yeah, like, can't say it any better than that, really. If you're where a turkey wants to be, you're I don't know what the percentage chance is of having an interaction, but you're so much more likely to have exactly what, you know, Tony was describing earlier on, where a turkey commits to your decoy setup and comes a running and gives you a chance to have, you know, what we all love to see as hunters on YouTube or on TV, where a turkey just attacks the decoy. You get to see some really aggressive strutting and all, you get to hear spitting and drumming. You get, kind of get to hear all the things, all the intimate moments of a turkey hunt that you're not going to get if you just crawl on up and shoot it on a field edge or something.
Yep.
It's such a better experience.
It is. And you know, one thing, you know, it's different here where I live, 'cause we're dealing with a lot smaller woodlots, right. But the one thing I learned, especially when I started taking my girls out and taking some people who are just like had very little experience, is when I started running trail cameras for turkeys just to see, it was such a confidence booster that on some of the logging roads and some of the edges, like you talked about, it was a guarantee that every day birds would walk through some of those spots. Like yeah. I've got a spot here that's between two basically cattail sloughs. And it's just I found it deer hunting, but it's a phenomenal little high ridge that a lot of animals travel. And what it makes you realize when you run a camera on it is you're like, if you had the patience to sit there every day, you could kill a turkey without calling. Yep. But if you start calling in those spots, that's where they're going. And so you just realize like it does a little bit of it helps temper that desire to just run after the next gobble, because you know you're in a place that they frequent. Yeah. And it's such a huge psychological boost.
Yeah, I'm going to try this analogy. Let's see if it works, Phil. You let me know if you're picking it up. If you're already in the bedroom and you're calling your lady and you're like, hey, let's get busy. And you're already in the bed and there's candles lit and there's rose petals about and there's, you know, some Barry White playing in the background. It's much easier to get everything going than it is if you're like, you know, in the kitchen cleaning out the garbage disposal. Phil, did that work for you as an analogy?
Wow. I mean, that's not my experience at all. I get, you know, I'm most successful when I'm cleaning out the garbage disposal, but I totally see what you're saying though. Yes.
Got it. I did a whole presentation one time about turkeys where I just made all the analogies about dating. And it was, people laughed, but I think at the end they were like, we're not going to have him back. He's not going to come back. I'm not really, even when we're in like peak strut, when turkeys are fired up and they're more susceptible to calling, I always kind of like to figure out where they want to be. I always do. I don't like running up to the roost tree and thinking he's going to fly down and pitch over and walk right to me. That almost never happens. It's one of the most enticing but foolish moves I think most turkey hunters make, is to think like, those turkeys are in a tree. If I just get right over here on the field edge, they're going to fly right down the field, come to me. I just, through my experience, I know that seems enticing, but it just isn't the way that it normally goes down. If you're 700 yards away, and in our case, Phil, there's a couple of little meadows right off the cottonwoods over this river where they're going to roost. If we're there, I mean, we could roll right up to the river's edge, to the creek edge, and sidle up in there and try to be really quiet and have them pitch down in our laps. Or we could get into these couple of these small meadows where we know they're going to want to be anyways, and just be patient. And work them, call them, be aggressive if we need to, kind of check their mood, but also know that they're kind of heading our way anyway. So you got a little confidence where that's, it gives you just a little more confidence, and you know you're not bumping birds. You just kind of in a position where you're just pulling that string slowly to get them to come your way. Is there any other things about, you know, just the way that this goes in the mornings? I mean, we can, Tony and I could probably go forever, Phil, to describe why it's awesome. Why a morning in the turkey woods is never a bad morning. Like, that's probably an interesting thing to talk about.
I would add something to that, Ben. Like, I agree with you that that roost, you know, fly down from the roost, kill them right away thing, that is an oft talked about situation that really doesn't happen nearly as much as we make it seem. We kind of conflate the really callable birds with the really enjoyable gobbling off the roost. Like, that, there's different things that go on. Yeah, you can kill one right away, but being out there at sunrise is awesome because you hear them, and there's always something going on. I mean, it's so rare to not have something worthwhile to be there for, but the birds that are killable and really are going to play the game well, they're the ones that you run into later in the day. And, you know, at least often, and it's a hard thing to, for a lot of people to get through, is you have that rush of excitement right away. And then you get, a lot of times you have that dead period and it's hard to stick with it, but you get that bird at 11 o'clock in the morning who hits you out of the blue. That's the dude you take home. You know, it's just, but it's a hard thing to, for a lot of people to get over until they've killed a few at that time, you know?
It is. Yeah. And like you said, I mean, it's better with new hunters, because you can kind of dial back some of the more aggressive, you know, tactics that you would use, right? Because you just don't want to do it. One, it's not a good of experience. I know you've probably done this, Tony. I've killed a lot of turkeys hunting solo, where I just said, I know how I'm going to kill this turkey. I'm not going to wait. I'm going to go over here and make it happen. I don't have the time or the patience. I know, I understand how this needs to get done, and having the ability to move on your own and just, you know, I've crawled a lot of turkeys up, popped out of the grass and shot them in the face. Like, I did, you know, that's not something you're going to do, one, with a new hunter, or really with more than one person a lot of times.
Yeah.
And to the extent that, Phil, you and I aren't going to split up when we're out there, I'm going to be with you. I'm not going to, a lot of times in calling sequences, you know, I might go back 50 yards, 75 yards or whatever. Maybe pretty less than that, but I think we'll just stick together and we'll be sitting together and we'll be talking through everything, and we'll be able to kind of put ourselves in a situation to have, I think, a better, I guess, cadence of how a turkey shows up, rather than just charging at one or having it randomly. I guess they could always randomly surprise us, Tony, at any point in time. That's what they tend to do.
Yeah. And I would say too, one thing with that is, especially if you're going to maybe set up a little bit behind him or something in a certain situation where you won't be there, I'd recommend you had a, like something to snip the weeds off and maybe a little saw with you. And every tree that you're going to put your back to, I would make sure you kick out a spot so you're down to bare dirt, and you swing through your options with your shotgun. So, you know, if that bird does surprise you a little bit, and you're a right-handed shooter or a left-handed shooter, you have the ability to move around a little bit without making noise or, you know, bumping your barrel into a, you know, deadfall or whatever. Yeah. Like, it just that a little extra, you know, it always feels rushed, especially if you have a bird close, but a little bit of extra time prepping that spot for the, you know, the thing you don't expect can really change the game too.
Yeah, that's good advice, because that's the thing with me. I'm mostly, I'd say in my life, like a path of least resistance person. So that's just something I never would have thought of. You know, I would have just sat my butt against a tree and been like, oh, I'll just work with this. Well, I'll work with what I've got. But yeah, putting in that little extra effort to clean it off, make sure you're prepared for all situations. That's stuff that I would not have thought about.
And we're working on, I got a Spartan tripod that I want to try to use. I've never used for turkey hunting. And again, I might take it out and just mess with it just so I know it a little bit better, Phil. But having a tripod with kind of a V-notch rest on it is something I've been thinking about, because it's easy to throw down and you can just sit your gun in it. And then you kind of know you know, you kind of know your stable when we start working a bird. You know, you kind of understand. You can't, unless you leave that V notch, you're always going to be kind of in that and stable. Have you ever done that before? You do that with your girls, Tony?
I do it with them for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we have, I don't like it for myself, but
yeah,
for them, you know, my goal is to put those birds in the decoys at like 10 or 12 yards. And their shot is only at a bird that's right there. Like it, you know, I'm not giving them the freedom to swing on one that busts us coming in or anything like that. So it's perfect to have I have a nice tripod rest for them. That's like very minimal effort to aim right at a turkey that's in the spot we want them to be.
Phil, do you find yourself calm under pressure, or do you feel like I'm freaking out, man? Are you going to freak out on me, or are you going to stay calm?
Oh no. I mean, I think especially with this, where I don't really have like high expectations, I'm just kind of along for the ride. I don't see myself going into like panic mode. But you know, we'll see what actually happens.
It's possible that I'm back there panicking.
Sure.
Yeah. It's probably more likely that I panic than you panic.
Uh-huh.
In this situation, because I'd be so excited for you. And you're pretty, you know, blasé about it. You're like, yeah, I'll be out there. If turkey comes, that's cool. But sure. I'll be back like, oh, Phil's got to kill the turkey.
This is, yep.
So, hey, Ben, I got a question for Phil. So,
yeah.
Phil, do you have any standards for which turkey you might shoot?
You know, we have not talked about this at all. So I think this might be something to maybe just go over briefly now. I don't know.
Yep. Yeah, do you? I mean, Phil, you probably don't really understand the differences between a mature bird, a 2-year-old, do you know what a Jake is, for example?
A younger turkey.
Yeah, that's part of it. run him through, Tony, like the gamut of turkeys he's going to run into out there.
Okay, I mean, this is going to be an important lesson here.
Sure.
Phil. Any bird with a beard on his chest, even if it's a 2-inch beard like a Jake, or a 11-inch just hog swinging away there, shoot him in the face.
Got it.
Yep. If it doesn't have a beard, don't shoot it in the face.
Okay.
Got it.
And pay attention. So, Ben, I don't know if you know this about me, but I am a huge advocate of shooting Jakes.
I like that. I like the way you put it. I don't mind a good Jake or a Jake shot or two. You're like, I'm a huge advocate of it. Please explain. Yeah,
I don't like, I've spent a lot of time playing in this big deer world, and I'm pretty burned out on the turkey, or I mean on the trophy thing. And I just don't think it has a place in the turkey world, especially for new hunters. And if you have a Jake come in or a couple Jakes come in, they should be on the menu, buddy. You should be more worried about putting that bead or that red dot right where it needs to go and killing them than worrying about turkey trophy size.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm the guy who's trying to kill 10 turkeys a year just to augment or replace our white meat consumption in my house by request of my wife. So I don't think she cares, Jake or Tom.
Well, Tony, you said that as if it's like a controversial or opinion. Is the reason that maybe people would disagree with you, is that for like conservation reasons, or just like trophy reasons?
It's just a trophy thing. Like, yeah. And I will say that part of the disdain for shooting Jakes that some people have is because some of them don't play the strut gobble game very well. And so you get more drive-bys with just little flocks of Jakes that aren't really strutting and giving you the show. And so it's just not as fun.
You don't really, but
at the same time, those people aren't passing up 3-year-old birds that aren't strutting either. Like it, but you get less Jakes that play there are fewer Jakes that play the fun game, but you do get some of them that come in full strut and fighting and attacking and, you know, but even if you get the quietest, most timid, shy Jake ever, and he's just walking by your decoys, I strongly urge you to shoot him in the face.
Yeah.
Noted.
I'll probably be urging you to do the same. But just to be clear, like a Jake is an immature 1-year-old male turkey. That's what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And we would talk about, like, in our vernacular, Tony, we would normally say like 2-year-old bird, where we know this is an immature male, but he is graduated from Jake to Tom. He's just a 2-year-old turkey acts a whole lot different than a 3-year-old and 4-year-old Tom. You want to run him through that a little bit, Tony?
Yeah, I would say don't worry about that. Because
shoot them all in the face.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to tell. You know, 2-year-olds are dream birds because they look like big mature birds. You know, I mean, a lot of them they're pretty heavy and they're sporting pretty good beards, but they're just a little more suicidal a lot of times. They're the birds a lot of times that'll get booted out of the bigger flock at 10 in the morning or noon, and they go out cruising, and they're all about fighting jakes, and they're the ones that put on a great show and they're awesome to kill, but they're different than, you know, an old bird, you know, a big hook spurred bird. They're, especially on public land, they're a little bit different, and you kind of can tell sometimes when you watch them, especially if there's some interaction with other birds or some hens, then you can see that little bit more of a dominance thing going on, and you can see who's sort of running the show, and that's super fun. But that's just like a luck of the draw thing. If you get to witness that, you know, like if you have a bird come in that has a beard swinging, I would recommend not thinking about how old he probably is and thinking about how delicious he's going to be if you shoot him in the face.
Got it.
That's why Tony's here, boys and girls. He's here to give you the real juice. One thing I will just say, identifiers, if just so you know, the tail fan, the central tail feathers, I guess we'll call them. I don't know how many tail feathers exactly is it. Do you know? Like four?
Four. It's usually four. Yeah.
Yeah. Four tail. We'll just call them the central tail feathers, and his fan will stick up about 2 or 3 inches above the rest. And that's just because during their first summer, a Jake will molt and lose most of its feathers besides the beard and then besides those central tail feathers. So they stick up a little bit higher.
Yep.
So that's how you'll see it when they're trying to strut or acting like they're an actual gobbler. I'm right there with you. I had a buddy who I was hunting with, teaching a little bit of turkey hunting last year here locally. We didn't do a whole lot of hunting together. We went out a couple of mornings, and he ended up shooting a Jake and was like, "Oh, I shot a turkey." I'm like, "You shot a turkey, dude? That's awesome." He's like, "Yeah, it was just a Jake." I said, "I don't care." Don't say that, man. Like, just,
yeah,
you filled your tag. That is, do not look down upon filling your tag in that way. So agree, 100% agree on that, Tony.
Yeah. It's way more satisfying to make that first really good shot than to care about, you know, how big they are.
There you go. All right. Well, what else, Tony? We can talk about call. I don't want to talk about calling as much, but one, because I'll be doing most of it, if not all of it. And I just really want Phil you to focus on, unless you're interested in it, Phil, or maybe you have some questions, but we've gotten, you know, almost 45 minutes into a conversation. Let's just do it that way. Phil, you got any questions that you want to ask? Anything like particularly that you're nervous about, excited about, you think we might be full of shit on?
No, I'm not. I would never accuse you of being full of shit, since I know absolutely nothing. So I'm just here to listen. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't like it's because it sounds like, Ben, you've thought this out. You've thought our game plan out more than you have relayed to me. So that makes me feel better. I'm just here. I think I mentioned this briefly before. I think you really want me to have like a successful hunt. You want me to shoot a turkey. Obviously, I would like to shoot a turkey, but I won't be disappointed if I don't. Is it foolish of me to like not want you to hand this to me on a silver platter? Yeah. And is it foolish of me to think that's even a possibility?
I'm glad you brought this up because you said this to me before, and it's something that it's worth talking about, right? That you're like, I don't want to be, at some level, I am going to be the arbiter of your experience. I'm going to take you out and show you either how I do it or how I'd want to do it, and then give you that one fairly limited approach to turkey hunting. Because there's not just one way to do any turkey hunt or to attack any scenario. I mean, you could do the hunt we're going to do, you could probably do it about 10 or 15 different ways, depending on how much, you know, what you valued from a turkey hunt. But I think I don't know what you think about this, Tony, but the way I look at that is there is just killing a turkey in and of itself comes with so many challenges. Just getting a turkey within range and then pulling the trigger on it and having it fall right there. Once, you know, I don't know how many turkeys I've killed, but every time I do it, my first thought or my first emotion is generally a sense of relief, because I understand how hard it is to do, even if we do it every year, and even if every once in a while we run into a bird that just seems like the dumbest animal to ever walk on 2 feet. Even if that happens, you still know that a lot of things have to go right to get that bird in and to kill it. So I would just say that, like, wanting a challenge is understandable, but there's enough challenge in just getting out into the woods, understanding the turkey, having it come in, put that red dot on the right spot and pulling the trigger and killing it. I think that's a hell of a challenge. And it's also kind of like the initial barrier to get over, so you can understand, how did I feel when I killed it? How did I feel when I ate it? Because those are generally going to be the drivers to have you understand the activity, but then push you forward to want to do it again. And so that's just how I think of it. But I do understand somebody saying, I don't want, you know, is it really hunting if you just take me out in the woods and sit me down against a tree and hand me a shotgun and do some calling and a turkey comes walking in? Is that really hunting? Did I learn anything? I guess I would say yes. You got any thoughts on that, Tony?
Yeah, oh, yeah, man. So Phil, your concerns are spot on there. And Ben, you're falling into the same trap I always fall in, where I want it so bad for them.
I know.
I tend to sort of put the blinders on and forget there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on out there. And so it sounds like, Phil, from your position, it sounds like it's going to be a lock, but it won't be.
Yeah.
I guess it won't be as easy as it probably sounds, even having somebody really kind of set it up for you. And the thing that it's like kind of easy to forget about is there's literally no time other than maybe September where it's more badass to be out in the woods at sunrise than it is in, you know, late April, early May. Like it's freaking awesome out there. You never regret it because there's so much to see and the songbirds have coming back up and it's a wild experience. And so it's more than just like getting out there and getting over the hurdle of the first bird. But like Ben is in that mode because that's what we do when we take people out, but you'll see that there's a lot more to it. So it's like, it's easy to get worried about like, oh, is this going to be too easy? And you could, yeah, it doesn't sound like your situation, but you could set up turkey hunts to be so easy that they weren't satisfying. That's not going to be this one. Like you're probably going to work at it a little bit and probably fail some and see how it really goes. And what I would say too on that is go into it with the idea that you want to see how this stuff goes, not just like show up and, you know, be told what to do, but get out there and scout a little bit and build in, like earn this a little bit. Like that's what I'm trying to get my little girls to do when we go out, we put out blinds or we scout. It's like, I just want them to see this process as more than when I take them out there in the morning on opening morning and we've got the birds roosted and the decoys out and everything set up really well. Like there's a lot to it and that's what makes it fun.
Yeah. And I think the satisfaction and all that compounds with the more work and time you put into thinking about it. You know, if I were to just say, hey, Phil, you want to go hunt tomorrow morning? And we hadn't talked about it previously at all. I'm like, okay, well, you got to take your hunter safety course. You get that? Nope. All right. Well, we got to do that. And I think the way that you become legal in the sense of hunting and the way that you've had to do it makes you think about it a little bit more anyway. But then when you get to the actual act of it, the satisfaction of the act is compounded by how much work you put into it, how much thinking you do, and how much critical thought that starts to become, you know, part of the game for you. So, I mean, I guess you just get out there and it'll be part, I just want to enjoy myself and enjoy this morning in nature or this day out walking around in the woods. I want to focus in on learning this craft because it is a craft. And learning this animal. And then once it happens, I want to focus in on like, what did I enjoy? Why is this fulfilling for me? Is it? Maybe it's not. And then you go home and you cook it for your family and decide if that part is ultimately the most fulfilling part for you. So it's a ton. I mean, we've had people on here that hunted their entire lives that are still talking about particularly their why and what they do and how they approach things. So there's certainly not one way to do it. That's for sure. Does that sum it up, Phil? I'm trying to find this quote from David Peterson from Heart's Blood. It was such a good quote. Any other, what do you think about that, Phil? Is that enough? Or you feel like we're going to, Tony's right. I'm going to be so driven to get you a turkey. I'm going to forget some stuff that I probably should have told you or forget.
Well, I'll make sure when we're actually in the field, Ben, I'll make sure to ask questions. I think that's where most of my questions are going to pop up. Like, I'm sure you're going to start doing something, calling a certain way. We're going to be looking in a certain direction, walking a certain direction. And I'll make sure to be like, well, what is the purpose of this activity that we're doing? Why are you doing this? Why are we doing this at this moment? Because I think that's where most of my learning is going to be done. It's just questions that I haven't really thought of yet that I'm sure I will once the activity is taking place.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, it's
I'll scare all the birds away with my questions, Ben. I'll talk to my
like,
loudest.
Hey, Ben, is that a Jake? I can't see its tail feathers. But I think that is too, like, when it's with your kids, you have an understanding of who that person is and your role as a father, or if you're with your wife and your role as a husband. When we were somebody, you know, this is for us a year where hopefully a lot of listeners of this podcast and a lot of people that are joining us are looking to find someone to mentor, are looking to find someone to take out. And a lot of doing that is taking the time to learn the person, to ask them questions, to understand what they're really trying to get out of the damn thing. And then work with them on that. Because when you're out there, you kind of have to have a mutual understanding, because turkey hunting can be really boring if the person that is the mentor doesn't understand what the mentee is trying to get out of the whole thing, or what they're trying to explore. And I think you find that, Tony, that's often you can kind of get yourself twisted up if you don't, you know, have that understanding and have some empathy going into it.
Oh, big time. And the biggest problem you have if you're a mentor is just ignoring the needs of whoever you're taking out. You know, if you're looking beyond that, you know, when you mentioned taking my wife out, I mean, the first two times we turkey hunted together, we got as close to divorce as we've ever gotten. It was horrible. And part of it was because I cared so much and she didn't hardly care at all. She's
uh-oh,
like,
Phil.
I just,
this sounds like us.
But I'll tell you what, we started having fun when I just finally said, okay, she wants to hunt a couple times a season. She wants to hear some stuff, see some stuff, and just be comfortable. And I just had to back off the gas and go, okay, this isn't about me going guerrilla warfare on a dumb bird. This is about her experience. And, you know, she was right. Like it was better for her to hunt her way. You know, I mean, you still got to push a little bit because you still want some success. And if you know what you're doing and they don't, like you got to lean into that a little bit. But I've seen the same thing with so many of the people I've taken out where it's, if they're digging it, you can tell. And if they're kind of suffering through it for you, you can tell if you're honest about it and you really want them to just be into it. So if it means cutting down, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning versus staying out there all day, like it's kind of what you have to do. It sucks if you're really driven, but it's just the way it is.
Yeah. We talk about that a lot here where even for turkey hunting, I have a way that a cadence in my life where turkey hunting becomes important. It's right around, I say Happy New Year. And then I start thinking about turkeys immediately. January 2nd. I'm thinking about turkeys. I'm like, while I'm ice fishing, I'm thinking about turkeys. And that's me. Is that you, Tony? Or are you earlier than that?
No. I because that's when deer season ends, yeah. And I start getting. It's part of the reason I scout turkeys so much. I don't really need to. I just. It's like something to do. You're kind of in the realm of just getting ready for this thing that I love so much. And you know, Ben, you know this. Like, this is what Phil really pay attention to. This. I'm 40 years old, and I'm starting to look at this stuff like, how many turkey seasons do I have left? Like how many elk seasons do I have left? And like you, especially with my little girls getting a little bit older, I'm like painfully aware that there's only so many Aprils and Mays that I can get out here and do this in so many states I'm going to hunt. And I just want to like enjoy it as much as possible. And it seems stupid, you know, cause hopefully I have a whole bunch left, but you become like acutely aware of how fleeting turkey season is. If you yeah. really love turkey hunting, it doesn't last long and then you're stuck waiting for another year.
Yeah. Yeah, because I desperately want Phil in this case to be as into it as I am. Like, I just, he has been so, it's taken me so long to get him to this point. I am so desperate for Phil to be like reading the 10th Legion and go like, oh my gosh. Because and that's one thing as I'll return again to so many people that listen to this podcast taking out new hunters this year. When you create something in your head, like I've created hunting where to me, I'm not the best hunter in the world, but I love it. I think about it almost all the time. Like, yeah, I watch sports. Yes, I do other things, but mostly all the time I'm thinking about hunting. Like, and it goes, as we were talking about, in cadence. It's a yearly cadence. I get to thinking about turkeys, then I get to thinking about tag applications, then I get to scouting turkeys, as Tony said, way too. I'm glad you said that, because I scout turkeys way, way more than I need to, because it's that time of year. There's not nothing else to do, and you want to get outside, and you're obsessed with it, and you're like, yep, they're still there. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yep, they're still there. Wintering flock. All right, they're still in the same field. They're in every morning. But I think one of the challenges here, and this is something that I think people often stumble on, is exactly what we've been talking about, which is I want Phil to kind of experience turkey hunting the way I have, or the way I do, through that lens, because I think it would lead to a certain type of passion that gets me up in the morning. And I want to say it's changed my life, but kind of has. But they're like putting that pressure on him, or putting that pressure on any mentee or somebody you're taking out in the woods, is a little tough to say, like, I want you to understand and love this the way I do. It's really just like, I want you to come with me and get out of it what you're going to get out of it. And if you happen to want to read the 10th Legion every year, twice a year by the end of March, okay, great, man, because that's what I do. But you don't have to. And I think sometimes we set up these kind of weird barriers around taking new people hunting, because you want to assign to them your own experiences.
Yeah, and sometimes it doesn't work very well.
Yeah, I can't remember ever having. I do remember one turkey hunt in Florida where I was sitting in. I was trying to get my first Grand Slam, and I was all into this. I was explaining what a Grand Slam is, why it was important to get my first, and we had a young lady along with us who just had never hunted before, and I didn't even care she was there. I was trying to get my turkey, and she was with us, but I didn't know. I didn't bring her along. She wasn't my mentee or anything like that. She was just with us, and she asked if she could come. I said, absolutely, you know, come sit in the blind with us. And I don't even think we told her, like, this is what a turkey does. This is what you might see. She just sat there, and we worked a bird. He came in. He didn't come into range, and then he walked away. And later on, she was like, I don't understand why you guys were so excited about what happened this morning. Like, I thought that was, like, I've seen turkeys in fields before. I don't understand why we spent so long talking about it afterwards. And I just thought, well, no wonder. She just came, and we didn't even address that she was there or talk her through any of the things. I was so dialed in that I just didn't think of it. So I guess that's a pitfall, Tony.
Yeah. There are times when you should just be hunting by yourself.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah. You have to. Expectations are an important part of hunting. That's for sure. As we talk about with trophy hunting and shoot every Jake you see, like, the expectations kind of drive everything else, you know. It drives your perspective, and it drives the, you know, your satisfaction at the end of the day, or your want to go back.
Definitely. And I will say this on that note, I will be extremely disappointed in Phil if he doesn't become a lifelong turkey hunter out of this. Situation.
I know. I mean, I think there's thousands of THC listeners. We've started a cult, and we have, if you don't know this, Tony, we have I think we have 47 state chapters of our podcast. They all have leaders. They all are organizing, and we're organizing around, mentored hunts. That's basically what we're doing. So, Phil is kind of like, what would you call yourself, Phil? You're like, you're not necessarily the mascot per se. You're way more important than that. You're like a deity within the THC listener.
Don't like that.
You don't like that.
No.
Yeah. It feels like there's a lot of space between mascot and deity.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like say, to leave let's it wide find open. A middle ground there, Ben.
All right. Well, you're well respected within the THC community. So people are rooting for you. They are openly rooting for this to happen and have been for some years. We've made them wait for a long time for this. So no pressure, but it's a bit of a different situation than just taking anybody, any normal person out on a hunt that's not going to be followed and recorded.
Yeah. Well, I do feel that encouragement and that sort of pressure, but it's honestly not really having any effect on me, which I think is, which I think is good. I mean, I guess it's not having a negative effect on me. How's that been?
That's good. That's good.
Okay, good.
That's what we would want, man.
Great.
You got a lot of support out there. And so I hope this helped a little bit just so you could hear a little bit of the way this might go and a little bit of the thought processes. Any last questions for Tony while he's here, Phil, before we let him go?
No. I mean, I'm trying to think if I have anything lingering that is kind of like a something to ask before I actually get out there and experience it. Best turkey dish, Tony.
Ooh. Oh man. Well, I mentioned 17 times on this podcast that I have twin 9-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And so we are really big. This is going to be embarrassing, but we are really big into turkey nuggets right now.
That yes. I have heard that. You know, you shouldn't be embarrassed because I've heard that from so many people. How that's just kind of like a staple, like a go-to, especially with people with
and it's,
with
kids. It's not
and I do have two kids, so I can imagine
there
that would
go.
Be that'll be popular.
Oh, dude, nuggets. So good.
Yeah, so good. And you can go out and get yourself like the Chick-fil-A sauces if you want. You get a little sauce, you know, a selection of sauces for the young lads. That'd be interesting. But yeah, I am. It's either turkey nuggets or. Everyone listens to this show will know that I'm a big fan of turkey cordon bleu. Like that's a real fancy. It's not really fancy. It's got cheese inside of it. It's not fancy.
it's got a French name, so it sounds fancy. Yep.
Yeah, cordon bleu. Yeah. But it's really like cheese and ham inside some turkey. Yeah. It's not really like. It's more redneck than it sounds in name.
It's delicious though.
It is. It is. But I would say turkey nuggets. Like let's celebrate. Turkey nuggets. In fact, we're probably going to put that in the title of this podcast, a celebration of turkey nuggets, because they are, you get some dipping sauce, you get the right spice combinations, and it is just, there's nothing better.
Yeah. Hashtag normalized turkey nuggets. We'll make some merch.
Yeah. hashtag turkey nuggets. That's a good place to end. Tony, thank you for joining us. And you can now find Tony. Okay, very soon. We haven't really let the cat completely out of the bag yet, but very soon Tony will be available for you to listen to. You'll be able to listen to Tony coming soon on a podcast near you. How about that?
That's a perfect way to put that.
Perfect. I'll do my best. Well, thanks, Tony, and keep us updated. I'm going to go and finish packing for Texas. And I'll keep both you gentlemen updated on our success or failure. And really, I see all my turkey hunting from now until we hit the field together as a training so I can do my best for you. I can be in tip-top turkey calling shape for you. And I'm going to give you my absolute level best effort out there. Okay? I promise.
All right. Same from me.
All right. That's a dedication. All right, Tony. Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
That's it. That's all. Another episode in the books. We can't do any of this without actually acknowledging Kayla Ray. This is our first episode with the brand new music as just a baked in thing that we do from in the future for this great podcast. So thanks to Tony Peterson. Thanks to Philip Engineer. Philip had to go run off and record a Meat Eater podcast with Steve Rinella. So that's what he's doing right now. So it's just me flying solo for the wrap up here. But I'll say I'm excited about turkey season. I'm heading to Texas to go try to kill a couple of birds. And I'll be back, as we were talking about in our interview with Tony, to try to kill a bunch more birds and try to get to my magic number 10 for the season to provide all the meat that we need for my family here. So I'm excited about that. This is it. This is the time. Go enjoy the outdoors. We've spent a lot of time on this podcast over the last couple of months talking about controversial topics, talking about hunting contests and black bears being banned and all the things that I think are critical But could be a good time to enjoy spring, take a break, think about turkeys, read the 10th Legion, and mentally prepare yourself and get yourself out in the woods. It's turkey season. Let's focus on that. We'll be back next week. We're going to have an update for you on our THC regional chapters and state chapters that are happening out there. If you want to join one of those chapters, go to Facebook and search for THC and the state that you're in. Shoot me an email at thc@themeatier.com. If you can't find those state chapters, we're continually working on the best way for you to be able to be plugged into what's happening on a state by state level with this podcast and with our new group. Shout out to Nuri Hong. Shout out to Luke Reeves and our leaders, all of you that are leading THC into the future. We'll keep it on going. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Clean your gun and tune your bow. We're the Hunting Collective Show. Calling hunters new and old. The Hunting Collective Show. Working pick and shovel or working pen in hand. We congregate now as lovers of the land. Mindful and we're focused, we're just living for the search. Dreaming of a fire and a salty Gilbert. But we ain't coming back till it's cold and late. We're taking it slow so we can shoot straight. Clean your gun, tune your bow. We're the Hunting Collective Show. Calling hunters new.